before we start this podcast, I wanted to just raise a question, and this isn't pre-thought. I've just thought of it now, Danny Sampson from Uncommon, and Ellie Gould from Unknown on my right, not my left this time, because I'm not in the main chair. When did the ED from chilled get deleted from the English language?
The ED?
Okay. Have you met Dave? He's really chill.
Oh my God, that was proper like school vibes.
What? Really? Is that how long ago it was?
I feel like you'd say chilled, like, oh yeah, everything's really chilled.
Chill.
Chill.
Everything's chilled. Really chill. I don't even know if it was part of my vernacular. I'm not even sure. Although random was like, when did random get cast?
Yeah.
That's where I'm at. Oh my God, that is true.
We'd be like,
why did it? That's so random. Have you seen Ellie? She is just so random.
So random. That's school vibes. Like, oh my God, I have. It was so random. Like,
and it will be the least random thing ever. It'll be like, someone will put their book down on the table. That is so random.
Oh, I think it got taken up by Netflix and chill. That's probably why.
It's been
sort of adopted by Netflix and they own it now. We'll just give it to them.
Yeah.
they can have
Humans became chill. Humans became chill. As in, like, that's what I found really weird.
Yeah.
Anyway, welcome, Danny.
Thanks so much for joining us
on Untalented this morning. All this afternoon, because this is a timeless podcast. You never know when someone is listening to this. I'm going to start by asking one of the weird questions. I feel like you're the kind of person that might want to dive into that. And I'm going to stick with invisible, right?
Okay.
So, Danny Sampson, if you were invisible for 10, only 10 minutes, what would you do with those 10 minutes and where would you go?
Oh, goodness. I thought about this before and I was like, it's a very logistical question. Am I here? Can I teleport? Is there any other superpowers involved in this? Or is it like, I'm in this room for 10 minutes?
Good. They're fair enough questions. Yeah. Because last time somebody teleported, I'm going to say you can teleport right now.
Okay, so anywhere
you
want.
You can't time travel though. None of that.
No time travel, but teleport. Oh, so this is going to be a really sad way to start the podcast. I'd probably teleport back to my grandma at the moment and give her a big hug. My family don't know this yet, but she's not particularly well. She's going to go through something. But yeah, it's not like, it's all
sending
good.
Sending positive love to Granny.
But yeah, I just...
We're sending love to Granny.
Yeah, I think I just pop back and give her a big old hug.
Aww. Yeah.
Granny hugs are the best.
Yeah. Oh, so much
they are so different from...
I love the passion that comes with granny hugs.
They are so good.
I'm going to dive in and ask our first question. This maybe it might be your grandma who was the person that made you first ever feel talented. But let me get that right. Who was the first person in this world that made you believe that you had talent, Danny?
Oh, actually, I think it was my uncle. So I had thought when we discussed maybe asking this question that it was going to be like someone that I had worked for or like a mentor or something like that. Mm. But my uncle had a really big role in my childhood, and I remember one night we were sitting outside of an Indian restaurant in, you know, well, fuck nowhere in Australia, Australia. and he sort of said, you know, Danny, you're the TP. He goes, you're the total package, Danny. And he's I think that
it's
was
so Australian that he's abbreviated. I love that. Or TPO.
I could have been toilet paper, who knows? Who knows where that was
going
to go?
Yeah, I was going like,
people could literally wipe their ass with you and they wouldn't even know.
that's
really sweet.
But yeah, he was very sweet. He used to help build toys and balsa doll houses and everything from scratch. Wow. We used to get like these model trees and all this sort of stuff. So he was very crafty as well, but just, yeah. Very talented.
Okay, and now, okay, so from being told that you were the TP from, I don't know, let's say 12 years old, 14, around that kind of time.
Yeah.
You're now a brand strategy director at Uncommon. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back to being a child right now and ask you to describe what that role is to the 12-year-old TP, Danny. How would you describe what you do now to that child?
Yeah, I think... It's anywhere from, and we were chatting about this as well, it's anywhere from that sort of business strategy stuff to creative strategy. But if I was to sort of explain that to her, I'd say people have ideas for businesses that solve problems in the world or are a creative expression of that. And you would be helping them articulate what they do, why they do it, and who they do it for. And also be able to give them sort of something creative and special about what they do, and help in that sort of all aspects of business creativity, really.
Okay, now I'm still Danny. Yeah. I'm 12, I'm TP. What do you mean? Tell me about an example where that's happened. What is a brand? Yeah. Give me an example of a brand.
I guess a brand is a business, or it's a creative expression of a business as well, depending on whether you consider a business an actual brand, or sorry, a brand an actual business, or a brand just a very sort of, I don't know, two-dimensional, create, like, you know, visual expression of that. But an example might be, trying to decide which business to use as an
Qantas
example.
Qantas Airways.
Airways. Qantas Airways. Yes, I Danny Sampson, did the brand strategy for Qantas Airways.
I am the brand strategy. The amount of, well, you're teleporting in 10 minutes. Maybe that could be quite a good advert for Qantas.
Okay, so let's talk about sex care or something like that, given that okay. that was this sort of thing. A duo came to us as a strategy when I was at Two Times Elliot, and were saying that they wanted to take on some of the conventional, sexist, sort of toxic masculinity, perceptions and sort of, I don't know, communications of Durex or sort of other monster sex brands. And so they sort of wanted to come in and tell a story. And I think as well, you know, you can build brand beliefs into a brand identity. So it's not just about how you operate a business or what service you actually give or provide or what product you produce, but also about the story that you're telling about what you believe that people can do or should do, or whether it's, you know, not even can or should, but, you know, this is what we believe and you can align yourself with that or not. So it's like, in that way, you sort of create a story around what sex is, I guess, or, you know, what it could mean, or, you know, what exploration looks like without it being sort of this hard and fast transactional thing, or having this sort of notch on a belt necessarily. And so slowing that down, and that's what I guess that whole brand was about, not just about providing sort of eco-friendly and sustainable and fragrance-free and natural and all that sort of stuff in terms of the product itself, but also about building a brand that was trying to express to people that they could slow things down, really, and sort of take their time and roam, like, is that end up being the name, but like roam freely, roam with wild abandon.
So this couple that have come to you at Two Times Elliot, which is a branding studio that you worked for before, they haven't got a brand. They're just going, we've got a thing, a product. It's like great for the environment, and we don't know how to brand it.
Yeah.
So people don't even come up with it. Like, sometimes they don't even come up with the name of their own business. They just know that there's, how do they describe that business if it hasn't got a name to you?
I guess they have, like, you know, it could be Brand X, or it could be, you know, a placeholder name, you know, in its essence, or, you know, at its foundation. But they will come in and express what they're trying to achieve, or what gave them that aha moment, I guess, when they thought that this is what they should do. And, you know, the founders of Lick Home, you know, that was the first strategy I did when I stepped off the plane to London, with Two Times Elliot as well. And, you know, they came in, and I think it was Lucas London, one of the founders, who used to say, like, people think that us doing DIY and paint is like really boring, but he's like, that's what's super exciting for me, because, like, it's a staid industry that basically can have significant change to it, and that's massively impactful. So I think them, you know, like, I've been really lucky to work with clients that have been incredibly passionate about what they do, and given that I've worked with a number of, like, self-funded and privately funded startups, they sort of come in and they have this grand vision, and they've been selling it and they want it, and, you know, if you can add a little bit or a lot, you know, of value to that, or help them realize their dreams, I feel like that's maybe the only altruism I feel like I can inject into what I do, really. At the end of the day, we're in the business of, you know, selling product or selling service, or, you know, I don't know, having this sort of convincing or grand thing. But yeah, I think that's, for me, what makes me excited to, like, bring new things to market that, like, tell stories, help people and all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Why did you join? So obviously you're at Uncommon, which is, I would say, arguably one of the best, if not the best, independent creative agency in London.
Yeah.
Now, for those that don't know, there's a creative agency and a branding agency. Branding agencies are normally agencies that will build the brand, like you just mentioned. Uncommon, more famed for their communications work or creative work, whether it's BrewDog, oh God, here I'm going to get caught out now, whether it's ITV, they make adverts usually, right?
Yeah.
Well, PR campaigns. Why would somebody who has been at a branding studio getting branding briefs, why would they join a creative agency?
It was really funny. I mean, you know, Ellie's been instrumental in that.
Is
that
it your
place.
Fault?
Yeah, yeah, it's Ellie's fault. Ellie's why I have sleepless nights.
That's why you reply to my messages.
When I left Two Times Elliot, I didn't really ever think I'd go back into a full-time gig necessarily that wasn't of my own, like, you know, my own sort of creation. It was just that Uncommon, as you rightfully said, has such an incredible reputation in the industry, and they really like stand up to it, you know, in a way. And it was like being thrown in the deep end there. But in terms of why, it was just, for me, incredible projects, incredible leadership, to the point of them just being such real people. You know, and they swear and they joke and they love a drink, and it never feels like it's sort of, you know, a mum or dad thing. It feels like they're sort of like a brother or sister or something like that. And it's like, has that sort of camaraderie. But, you know, and they want to put their finger up, I guess, to sort of convention and all that sort of stuff. And I have my thoughts around where you should and where you shouldn't do that necessarily. And I think, you know, that comes from culture and counterculture, and that always being this sort of pendulum. Yeah. Like, are we, yeah. But anyway, for the sake of progression, it's kind of nice to go, we're breaking down barriers or challenging things and doing that in such a ballsy way.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just, it's also, I think, one of those things where they don't have, they've grown so fast in 5 years. Mm. They don't have the rigidity or the processes, but in some ways they fight against that. And I know that they're probably in the process of finding a happy medium.
Yeah.
But that's been really exciting to be, yeah, as I said before, thrown in the deep end with just some of the most incredibly talented, you know, people in the industry, I guess. And I think in some ways that's why people go there. It's almost like an agora for brilliant creatives and, yeah, who can self-direct and yeah, I think that is the main thing, like who can very much self-direct and come together. It's like a mini sort of decentralized creative agency. But yeah, lots of... Yeah.
What's it like being on the outside? Because I guess, you know, you're not joining as a communication strategist to go and support, I think it's Lucy Jamieson that's the CSO there on the comms side. What's it like being the kind of, I guess, the brand side? You know, do you feel like you're a mini gang or a pirate ship attached to the Titanic?
That's right. I didn't even answer your question properly. I sort of just like rattled on about
No, it was a great answer.
I was like, no, but that's, it's, I think that was, I was sitting down with a mate like a few weeks ago, and I was sort of saying, you know, one of, like, I feel like I'm going to jump to the pet peeves thing at the moment. It's like, feel like people in advertising don't 100% get branding, and people in branding don't 100% get advertising. And I feel like at some points I've just been like, you don't understand. And they've been like, you don't understand. It's like, you don't understand. So we're just like, you know, rattling off one another. And but I think given that, I do really feel like they're trying to have this very open, creative, you know, mindset. So it doesn't come into this point of where you'd traditionally delineate or compartmentalize, this is what branding is, or this is what design is, or this is what art direction is, or this is what campaign is. And it's completely holistic. And one of the reasons, to answer your question before, that I went there was because I was like, big clients, bigger budgets, ballsier directors means that you get access to whatever you want. And it's sort of a better way to make dreams a reality and client dreams a reality. It's like, how creative can you be in a place where you get sort of the endless ability and sort of the leg up to be endlessly creative? But
can I ask a question on that then? So why is it taking Uncommon to be the first and only ones to do that properly? Because I've been involved and tried to help many branding agencies try and wear new clothes to become a creative communications agency. Vice versa is always really ugly, and branding agencies are like, can't believe they even try. Whereas, you know, some branding agencies will pop out a great comms campaign. I don't know which one's harder, you tell me. But why has it taken Uncommon, and what is different that's happening inside to go, okay, you mentioned looking at things holistically. What does that mean from the CCO to you? You know, how does that communicationally work out?
Well, I think the only other agency that I feel that people recognize that have done this was Mother and Mother Design, really. And so, you know, they have, I guess, sort of got a model that is leading the charge on that front. But at the same time, I had that chat with a friend about, you know, you don't get it, you don't get it. I also sat there and I said to him, almost rhetorically, would I prefer to build this sort of, you know, holistic agency on my own, or would I prefer, not that I could pretend that I could build a 140 person agency very quickly, but you know, would I prefer to go down that pathway, or would I prefer to make waves by actually being able to establish a brand agency within you know, I don't want to call it an advertising agency, but you know, within that sort of function. And that sort of felt almost far more rewarding in a way. So that's where I was there. But nice. I think it's not easy. It's like, I don't think Uncommon has necessarily succeeded perfectly at that yet. Like, we're very much in infancy stages around trying to navigate and massage what's right and how to get the right resourcing and what that brand project does look like and how to actually slow down a little bit, because it doesn't operate at the same pace as an advertiser, or nor does it need to. Yeah. And I think that's the understanding as well. So I think, you know, coming back to what it looks like internally is just, and I don't want to say it's about me, it's just, it would be me or someone else or whatever it is, but it's the attitude of empowerment, I guess.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been left to my own devices in some instances, and it's, you know, if I feel like things aren't going well, or if I'm frustrated by resourcing, or if I'm frustrated by timelines, I speak up.
Yeah.
You know, and it's about having someone who has, I guess, the sort of strength to step in and go, this isn't working, without just going, you know, what you guys are doing because you're big head in house or whatever is the right thing, and I'm just going to chug along and try and... I described it as like, I don't want to feel like I'm just trying to like shove branding into the crevices of an advertising agency. And so I think, you know, that's what... Yeah, they should be in some ways treated differently but similarly. And I think that will be, something... It'll be nice to see progress.
I want to ask you about the pisses you off thing, because I think it's important to understand this. But what does piss you off when it comes to doing a good brand strategy? It can be Uncommon. It can be anywhere you like.
Yeah. I always used to say that I would start every brand strategy off with hands-on research. That's the buzzword or my elevator pitch or whatever. Not that I was necessarily trying to sell, but more trying to explain, this is the way I like to do things, and this is the way I've seen it be successful, because you can take really emotional insights, you can test, you can look for repetition. I'm not, you know, a perfect desktop researcher. I'm not a hugely quantitative, data-driven strategist. I look for the sort of emotional stories and things, and those sort of brand belief systems that I'm trying to sort of help articulate. So, you know, I guess what bothers me in strategy is I don't like to assume I know the answer to something, nor do I like it when people assume they know the answer to something. And then we spend as much time trying to reverse engineer the logic as we could have just front loading the process with the actual research. Now, that's not a perfect science. Sometimes, you know, the research as well doesn't glean such a creative or ballsy or, you know, shocking or whatever outcome. And you do need to sort of like try and marry the two. But I think you're just having a clear, I think that I want to get to a point where even in my practice, I can start to delineate what is business strategy, what is brand strategy, what is creative or design strategy. Because there's actually quite big differences between like how do you operate as a bit like, you know, what do you do with product and service wise, you know, what do you stand for and how do you communicate yourself? And then what does that design look like?
As a brand strategist, what would you say gets in the way of like making good work?
Good strategic work or good outcomes?
Both.
Okay, because good outcomes, funnily enough, and I'm going to undermine this in a way, is say like when the designers maybe try and stick too specifically to the strategy as well, because it's like sometimes, you know, it's been happening on a project recently, and this is more from like the design strategy, not the brand strategy necessarily, but it's like there's this underlying grid and all this sort of stuff, and it's like And they're like, oh, we can't do this because it doesn't fit within this, you know, within this grid. Or it doesn't, we can't do this because it doesn't. It's like, forget the fucking grid. Like, forget the, like, you know, forget it. Like, if it doesn't, you know, if it does, and it's happened before, you know, at previous, you know, even at two times where it was like, you know, we'd have a mood board and we, you know, whether you're expressing that in terms of the way that that design system is going to work or whether you're expressing that in the way that the design sensibility or aesthetic is going to work. Mm. You know, they'd get to this point where they'd start testing it and they'd get into the design. You know, these were on the mood boards. They'd start testing and they'd go, but it's this, I can't do it. It's, I can't get this properly. Or like, you know, it doesn't make sense. Or, you know, I've got this idea, but it doesn't fit perfectly. And just, who gives a fuck? Forget the, like, forget the mood boards. Or forget the, you know, forget the strategy perfectly. If it sort of is on the, I guess it has to catapult you in a general direction. It's not about being so rigid.
It must be hard that. I was just trying to imagine like it being the design and hearing that, being like, wait, so I do the grid, I do the grid. Like,
yeah,
do
yeah,
I,
make up your mind.
Yeah. What, how is it, is it like, and I guess that's the importance of having true talent, right?
Yeah.
What do you think makes a harmonious relationship between the designer and a strategist?
My mum was in sandwich bars like back in Australia for like, so she was studying to be paralegal, and then like she married my father, and like his, you know, his brother was like running these sort of like sandwich shops and food courts. And so she bought that, and then she ended up franchising it to like 40 stores, and then wow. She, you know, it was like this whole thing, and she was like quite a businesswoman in her own right. And she then, you know, stepped out of that and then started a couple of burger stores basically in Melbourne as well, like in Australia. And she used to say this thing where she was like, I get my staff members to rotate when they're training, so that someone who works on till works at the bar, someone who works at the bar works on the grill, someone who works on the grill works, I don't know, cleaning the toilets or whatever it ends up being. And she's like, everyone should know what it takes to do everyone's job in a, you know, how long it takes to cook a burger, how long it takes to serve someone, where the mistakes come in, all that sort of stuff. And I think, you know, they can't just, for me, it's like, you know, and I sound like such a strategist saying this, I do love Venn diagrams, but like, you know, it's got to be the crossover, I guess, in a way where it's not like this car, like this hard, cold handover. And, you know, a designer with strategic thinking and a strategist with design thinking is really the only, like, in my mind, or at least in my experience, where you get the best, where you get the best possible outcomes. And that comes from also you challenging one another and saying, this isn't clear enough, or this isn't doing what it needs to do design-wise, or, you know, this doesn't have a feeling to it. I don't know, and just being able to articulate that. And I think, you know, having cross sensibilities is really helpful.
If you were to give a designer advice in how to better work with the strategist, what would you say to that designer?
This is the thing about designers, and they like, everyone designs differently, and I think this is what I'm learning. It's, some designers will look at a system and go, I'm gonna look at, you know, as an example, I've got a very good friend who did the fussy branding for the deodorant. We worked on that together, and, you know, part of what came out of the strategy was, you know, I think that Fussy should be a broadcasting agent for, you know, good things that are going on in the eco world. So rather than them sort of saying, you should be Fussy, or you should be eco, or you should be, you know, whatever, it's more about the idea of, we're just going to be a conduit for information here. And so it became this sort of broadcasting like platform. And, you know, she pulled that, you know, God bless her, she pulled that out of one of my biggest strategies and was like, you know, this is, because, you know, that's the thing, it was one idea, I guess, in a sea of many. And she sort of said, what is it that, you know, we can build on this broadcasting wise? And so she looked at, you know, ticker tapes and like stickers, because stickers, you know, back in the day was a way of actually sort of like physically broadcasting on the streets and you know, sending messages and things like that. And so, you know, she's a very systematic designer, and I appreciate that, because it builds out a graphic language. And I've referred to this a number of times, where graphic design isn't just graphic design, it comes from visual communication.
Yeah,
that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to visually communicate. And so that's not just in, and I have tried to synthesize my process, or the way that I brief as well, And I'm doing that through a bit of trial and error in Uncommon at the moment. And, you know, we're all aware of that and we're all working, you know, around it to try and systemize it in a way. But it's, you know, what's the story? What's the symbol? What's the design system? And then what's the sensibility? Because you can in some ways go, we're going to leverage this sticker system, but we're going to do it in the sensibility of old world block lettering, or, you know, like wood carvings, or, you know, we're going to use stickers and we're going to do that in like pop serotonin overload, you know, colors and vibrancy, or we're going to do that in futuristic renders and all this sort of stuff. And it gives it a different feeling, but it's like the same sort of design system behind it. So I think what I'd say to designers is like, you know, the weaker designers for me are the ones who just sit there and flick through typefaces and, you know, and then still aren't good at it, you know, and still haven't chosen, you know, what I would consider, not that I'm the authority at all on, you know, on things, but, you know, what doesn't appeal to at least my, you know, my sensibilities. And yeah, so I think just like having that grounding and that conceptual grounding and looking at it systematically and from a broader usage, like, you know, brand usage perspective versus just sort of these like, let's tick some boxes. And I guess that's where, you know, that bland thing has come in and gone like, here's a typeface, here's some pastel colors, like here's a, like, I don't know, a product on a colored background, and here's a, you know, and it's just like, we're just ticking. Yeah. They're like, here's some slightly characterful tone of voice work, you know, and that's where it's coming into just this sort of like real, yeah, brand vomit. Basically,
I don't think you could have answered that question any better. That was really, yeah. But for me, I've probably come from more of a creative communicationsy world where I've, you know, recruited those kind of people, and I've not ever heard somebody speak so eloquently about like the difference in design. Because I see the things you're speaking about, the serotonin overload and the block thing, and I'm like, oh wow, they've got names. I didn't even know that.
Okay. I mean, I might have made them up, so I don't really know. Yeah. Maybe they do have names.
Fair enough. Yeah. I want to ask one last question before I move on to kind of what's happening in the world right now. And that was more around, I guess, female leadership, and, you know, coming from Australia, I don't know what the case is over there, but do you feel there is, or there are enough senior female leaders in the land of strategy?
I mean, I guess the short answer is no.
Why not?
I mean, I was thinking about this as well, though, where it was like, I don't think, I mean, this comes to a broader societal and systemic, you know, thing, right? And it comes around the idea of, you know, men have had a head start just historically. And so that's just been the progression of things. And, you know, women have come in a little later and we're still, you know, growing and finding our feet. And that doesn't mean we're less capable. It just means that we've, you know, we've come up at slightly, you know, handicapped rate there. And so I guess in some ways it is just the lay of the land at the moment, and that will overturn, you know, in its own cyclical right. I think, you know, I know Jessica, like, I think I'd read something from Jessica Walsh a while back, and she was talking about how few female directors there are. And I get that, and I see it. You know, I've been lucky, I guess, in a way, and I feel like maybe it's just a bit of a bubble because I've actually had really strong female leaders.
Yeah.
And I've also had really strong male leaders, but that's, you know, I've learnt from them, you know, in the same way. And I guess it's funny because maybe it's more about maybe it comes back to my mother in the grand scheme of things, of seeing sort of a strong female entrepreneur and not feeling like I was ever handicapped for being female. And that isn't everyone's experience. And I need to empathize with that. And I do. I don't think that there's not an opportunity for that, though. I think nobody, well, not nobody, obviously there are prejudices and there are things, and I don't, you know, I'm, again, in a very privileged position. I don't want to sort of speak to what, you know, discrimination people are experiencing. But I would say just fucking rise up and claim it. You know, like, that's just like that sort of thing. I just love that.
Do you find, like, because obviously you speak to strategists the whole time, varying creative agencies, branding agencies. Do you feel like that is the shared attitude?
Pretty much. I think also, like, in the grand scheme of things, strategy is relatively new and emerging in agency world anyway. Yeah. So I completely hear what you're saying about, like, there needs to be more of an opportunity for it to actually happen. Like, because it's newer.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think, yeah, fair enough. I wanted to just, I guess, to probe on that because we, you know, we see quite a few stale male pals. Yeah. CSOs.
All the time.
All the time.
Yeah. All the time.
And I thought, you know, is there a reason behind that? I agree with what you're saying. And I think that it's a logical response, which is, yes, it is because the females have had a, I guess they're starting from a further back place. But right now, I guess all we can do is keep on empowering and pushing and pushing and asking for that to happen more regularly.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, I wanna move into this weird fucking AI thing, right? So I'm curious to hear what you think about this.
Yeah.
For those that don't know, there's a thing called Midjourney, which I would have thought sounded like a little, I don't know, halfway house when you're in fucking Singapore flying to Australia.
Yeah.
It's not. Midjourney is AI for design. You type in some keywords, you could type t-shirt, dress, apocalypse, and you would get this fucking mad t-shirt dress apocalypse.
What I'm wearing right now.
What you're wearing right now. And that is AI. Happening. So, okay, firstly, I'm hearing people go, oh my God, what the fuck? What do you think? I'm going to ask you straight up. What do you think about AI and design?
I kind of think it's exciting.
Oh, thank God for that.
I mean, I think there's a whole, like, I was reading this book around like cyborgs and things like this. I think his name's James Lovelock or something like that. But, you know, I think we're all slightly terrified of like just general technology overtaking. And, you know, turn on any sci-fi film and it's either about a pandemic or a robot like overlord or something like that. But it's, you know, I guess there's another side of that, like, so we can either be scared or we can embrace it. There's another side of that where it's, you know, I was listening to another philosopher speak recently about, you know, are we encouraging evolution for evolution's sake, and nobody's questioning the ethics of what is going on there and whether it actually is beneficial for humankind. And so I find that really funny, where it's this sort of this big overarching ethical question around is all progress?
Yeah.
In a weird way. And so
I think it is. Sorry, I just wanna just on that point. Okay, So
I'm not disagreeing, but I just said this it's
a good question
to ask. You know,
because it's like, when do you stop? Yeah. When do things start thinking for us?
Yeah.
There was a Brian Collins in the States, he wrote this LinkedIn thing where it was
Did you see that? Yeah, I saw it. It was incredible. Yeah.
I'm gonna fuck it up, but it says something like theaters feared movies and he used Macintosh. Graphic designers laughed at Macintosh, you know. I guess even recruiters laughed at LinkedIn or would fear LinkedIn.
Yeah,
what do they become? They become tools.
Yeah.
And actually, I find that particularly this Midjourney thing, most of the most creative people are diving in. They're going, this is wicked.
Yeah.
Because you type some things in and you keep your glucose because your brain's not going, fucking hell, where do I even start? You just go, which is how we start. Words in a thing. That's shit, but I'll use it and I'll go and do another thing. They're using it for writing as well, right? The writing AI is incredible because I spoke to George White at 10 Days and he was telling me apparently you just type in, you know, generally what you want to say and it'll pop out this amazing, pretty much near enough thing. And you tweak it as a writer and the gold, the writing bit that your ego wants you to retain is where you tweak it. And you go, cool, that was average. And now I'm going to make it.
If it wasn't good enough, I'm perfect.
That is it.
I totally agree. And I think, like, just to sort of wrap myself back around that, so it doesn't feel like I'm anti evolution, which would be a terrifying position to be in. I'm excited. And I've played with it, and it is interesting because in some ways the way that I've started to compartmentalize my process around that sort of system, symbol, sensibility stuff is like almost the inputs that you put into something like these sort of AI generators, and it's a like wonderful podium, almost like starting point for us to, and I guess that's the thing, right? Like the way that we evolve is from learning from previous generations, and it's always this sort of like evolutionary start point. And so, you know, I guess we're just starting a bit further ahead of the curve, you know.
Love
like
that.
I think it'll be fun.
Danny is pro evolution, just for everyone to know, right?
Pro-evolution.
Absolutely.
That's
tragic. Woo, go Darwin. So, okay. I'm happy with that. I want to speak about the second thing, which is, I don't know if you've been on your LinkedIn or your TikTok, but quiet quitting. Mouse twitchers, mouse shakers. People that essentially remain. I thought it was when you quit your job and you hand your notice and you do fuck all in your notice period, which is what everyone does. But this is not that. This is staying in your job and doing the bare minimum, like being like 4-hour work week sort of vibe, but in a fully paid permanent job. Why do we think this has come around? I personally think because in COVID, some people got to the bare bones of their job and went, "I can do this in 4 hours. I don't need 8." Yeah. And I like that. That was a great thing. And at the same time, you've also got these kind of Gen Zs going, "I don't want to be that stressed out, weird CSO or CEO or whatever the role is that I'm going to progress into.
Let's go on TikTok instead."
Yeah. So I'm going to go on TikTok and I'm going to start a little side hustle because my TikTok's telling me I need to start a side hustle. So for me, I guess I wanted to ask you guys both, really, what do you think about this quiet quitting thing?
I mean, harking back very quickly to Darwin, given that reference, right?
Why not?
It's just, it's a process of natural selection in some weird ways where it's like, if you're either not creating an environment that's engaging enough or exciting enough or, you know, giving people that sort of sense of empowerment or, you know, or if they can do their job in 4 hours, then who cares?
Yeah.
You know, like if it's, you know, and I think it's, that's where it gets down to this idea of, you know, we went through the Industrial Revolution where it was all like productivity, productivity, productivity. Mm. And it's funny because if I loop also back to this idea of like the evolution and sort of AI and starting from, you know, from a sort of like head start, I think, and I feel like this would be in one of those, like, I don't know where this came from, please don't quote me on it, I cannot, like, yeah, like, all this, but anyway, like, I feel like there was at some point a societal question when the Industrial Revolution came around, like, machinery came around, that there was a point in human history where we could decide as humans to do more work or less work. Mm. And I think we went in the more work direction. And I wonder, in a way, whether we've learnt or not learnt from that, and whether in this sort of technological evolution, or like, you know, yeah, like revolution, whether we get to a point where we do understand that we can use, you know, creativity is that commodity, and creativity as where the core value is, not productivity. And so I hate that I'm saying this, but that whole like work smart, not hard, you know, like, you know, work smarter, not harder thing. And I think that's, you know, when I spoke earlier about the sort of like the large strategies and things like that as well, it wasn't because I was trying to hide in those. It was because I thought that more was more, you know, and that if I didn't do enough, you know, that it wasn't good enough. And so, you know, as you get older, you realize that it's the quality, not the quantity, or not the amount of hours you put in, but the quality of thought. And, you know, that's the sort of stuff that I think. Yeah, so I don't know if they.
I know. I'm really happy to hear you say that.
It's like the 4-day week thing.
Yeah. Mm. Well, is it? Because I kind of hear what you're saying, but I'm also like, what is the purpose of? I think, okay, I'm very quickly going to say this.
People shouldn't take the. I guess there's this thing of like people shouldn't take the piss either.
Yeah, it's an attitude,
you know,
thing,
like,
isn't it?
Yeah, that's like the other thing of it, and it's like, you know, sorry, interrupt you. Like, I was like, yeah, like I had a, you know, I had a, like, I fought for sort of freedom and flexibility in my work very early on. Mm. You know, 6-7 years ago, I was, you know, even when I was like 24, 25, I was in my first job, like my first sort of professional job. And I was sort of going, anyway, more, yeah, like my first sort of like office job. But I would fight and say, I want to go work at a cafe, or I want to go do this at home, or I need quiet time, or I think I'm going to be better off going and being inspired at a museum to think about this stuff. And I, at a young age, in a large agency, was getting that level of freedom because I was asking for it. But then I also had asked at the time, why don't you allow other people to work this way? Mm. And my boss at the time said, Danny, you go home and you work, but if I let everyone go home and work, they won't work. And so it's this interesting thing of, I guess back then it was, you know, it still comes down to that level of trust, and it still comes down to that level of, you know, worth and integrity and all of that sort of stuff. So I'm not going to say some days I'm only do 4 solid hours of work, but, you know, on another day I might have worked 10 or 12 hours, or, you know, I might be mulling something, you know, in the evening that's not allowing me to go to sleep, or, and it's just about like self regulating what you think is fair and reasonable.
Ellie, you're quite similar. I find that you're like that as how you work. Like you sprint.
Yeah.
And then like rest, almost like a lion.
Like a puppy Labrador.
What were you going to say? What were you going to say about 4-day week?
Well, the idea that like working smarter across 4 days rather than dilly-dallying over five. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
I agree, because that's the whole presenteeism thing, isn't it? It's like, I'm going to show up to prove that I can be here.
Yeah.
And I agree with what you're saying about designing the environment where the human being wants to be there, and you've given enough reason for them to be there rather than just for our sake. Thank you guys on Quiet Quitting. I want to make sure, because I'm getting I'm getting this feeling that we should be speaking about some blanding at the end. And Danny, I also want to, I don't know if you did bring along any elephant vomit into the room.
Oh goodness, it was it. I can make it up on the spot.
Okay, whilst you're thinking, and for those that don't know, the elephant vomit section of our podcast is about, we give our guests a moment to bring in something that they just want to put in the bin. Amen. Delete this from the industry. Vomit this dirty elephant out of your soul and let it leave your body and the industry at the same time.
Yeah.
I'm just going to, before you dive into that last point,
yeah,
I want to speak about blanding. Mm-hmm. So I looked at these like fashion brands. Okay, you've got Balmain, Yves Saint Laurent. I'm going to say some other ones in a sexy little French accent. But all used to Burberry. I don't know where I was going with that. Yeah. But okay, you've got all these brands that once had different typography and all that kind of stuff. And now you look at them, they're just, as you were saying earlier, block, capital, what you were saying, and blanding.
Yeah.
Is this a theme that's happening, or why does that happen?
Yeah. I think contextually, before I go into the whole sans serif, you know, black and white sort of space, a lot of like every brand wants to be lifestyle at the moment. Every brand wants to be content hub. Every brand wants to have collaborations. Every brand wants to be sort of club first. I sort of wrote an article on that recently that's in editing. Maybe it'll be binned. Who knows? Don't know. Anyway, but yeah, we'll see.
That was actually someone's elephant vomit.
But you know, this sort of, you know, this club first mentality. And I sort of speak about this idea that, this is really going off topic, but like speak about this idea that in, whilst like religious congregations are shrinking, we sort of look to our brands to set our identity systems and our guiding lights. And so, yeah, I'm sort of seeing that it's more than, I guess in some ways, like it's so much more than just that slab font on, you know, on white and black. But I also question, like, so yeah, so like there's, it's more than that typeface and it's more than that logo that like everyone's trying to build into these brands. So I guess in some ways what I'm saying is like, I feel like that's where the attention is going,
right,
more so than, you know, this ornate whatever, whatever. There's also, I think, the other side of going culture, counterculture again. And it always pendulum swings between culture and counterculture, and this will become the culture now. And then, I don't know, 5-10 years down the line, maybe they'll all rebrand back to serifs, you know, and that'll be the like, oh, look at us doing, you know, the polar opposite of what's going on. And,
okay,
you know, and that will sort of happen as well. I also was thinking about this the other day, and I was thinking, is usability, and not to sort of slag on usability because it's totally necessary and it's, you know, and it's empathetic and it's ethical and it's everything that it needs to be in this diverse world. But, you know, is sort of digital accessibility and usability sort of, is it causing the death of like the decorative in a way? And it's like everything really is about these very functional, readable, you know, devices getting smaller, you know, scrolling, death scrolls and blah, blah, blah. So I just wonder whether it, you know, I wonder whether that sort of a move from sort of a print or physical medium to a digital medium is also driving this sort of stuff. But wow, I guess there are a few different,
I like that, I mean, it's an interesting idea that it's, I like the idea of the pendulum swing, because you're right, that always, it's like fashion.
Yeah.
Although they say that fashion is the only cyclical industry that doesn't innovate. Oh. I think I've said that twice now on this podcast. Okay, hopefully you've had enough time to think about what you want to purge from this industry. If you, if Ellie, you're also welcome to purge something out. Is there anything, whilst Danny, you're thinking, Ellie, is there anything in the world, it could be in strategy, it could be in life, it could be in anything, that you would puke out of this of this industry? What pisses you off, Matt?
Oh God, you put me on the spot.
You haven't got to be smart. You can just tell me. It can be me if you want. It can be my car. A new obsession of car.
Oh, I don't I don't know. I can't think.
Danny, yeah. We're going to you.
Danny, you're going to you.
I'm going to like, maybe I'll ramble on a couple of things. We'll just see what's interesting. No, because I just wonder whether, you know, it's funny because I'm not sure that like there's anything I loathe entirely. I mean, there are the small things like 1,000 meetings, you know, 1,000 people on projects that don't need to be sitting in on meetings. Like there was advice that I was given a really long time ago that I haven't felt like big dick energy enough to like actually put into place. But like, I wish that like, basically they said, if you're in a meeting and you realize that you don't need to be there, excuse yourself and leave. Yeah.
You always say that though, don't you?
Oh, yeah, we have a thing. It's like, do I need to be in this meeting?
Yeah.
And if I don't, then let me know, because otherwise I'm just fucking hanging on. Yeah. To it, like a little dodgy cocoa pop at the end of the series.
Yeah. So it's just like that. And then what else? What else would I kill in this industry in terms of strategy and design? I mean, like, yeah, like, you know, the templated looking designers, like, you know, it just feels like we've taken it off Creative Market and just, you know, basically chucked it onto a brand. I don't know what bothers me enough. I don't know whether I get bothered enough.
Do you know what might bother you? People asking you what bothers you. That could be, maybe I've upset you on that front.
No, not at all. I was going to say, but we'd sort of spoken about this, and that was the idea that like, I was laughing because that whole like, you don't get it thing between like advertising and branding. Over the pandemic, I had a housemate who is is an advertising copywriter. And I feel like, you know, we explored psyches during that period of time where you're like locked in and almost, you know, sort of a bougie jail. But, you know, like you just kind of get to this point where it's like, he's like, I just don't feel like you like think what I do is like valuable. Wow. And I just don't think you take what I do seriously. And I was just like.
And you said, you're correct. Thick idiot.
Learn to write, for God's sake. Yeah.
And I sort of get it, because it's like, in a way, and like I think he's an incredibly talented copywriter, but I think what I didn't understand from not having been inside an advertising agency is just the amount of like rapid creativity and like raw creativity and, you know, lateral creativity that comes out of that. And, you know, with branding, we can be very much like, this is the process. This is what you do. You do the, and I've been like a victim of that to my own, you know, my own fault. But I'm excited that it feels like I'm in a period where, you know, there's like, they say, you know, a classical guitarist or something like that. You learn Spanish classics and then you get to break the rules.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, and I feel like that's sort of what you get when you sort of become, you know, a bit of a master, or you've done the hours, you've put in the hours, and you learn the process, and you learn the, you know, the theory, and you learn whatever, and then you break it and you start to, you know, write your own music. And I guess that's what I'm sort of excited for in the next part of my career.
You've just quoted Picasso in a weird way. Oh, did you know that?
I did not know that.
Learn the rules like a pro so you can break them like an artist.
Love that one.
Beautiful.
Love that
one.
Love that one. Danny, you've smashed this. You've got to be at a museum quite soon.
Oh, yes,
go
yes,
and
I
satiate
do.
Your creativity, and by the sounds of, do a meeting.
Yeah. Yeah, and then do a meeting.
But
yeah.
I want to say a huge thank you. This has been incredible. I just felt very calm in your presence. Oh. And I feel like you have a wonderful brain, an eloquent, very smart brain. So it's nice to hear you speak. Sweet.